This talk is sponsored by the Knights of Columbus, the Augustine Institute, Franciscan University, and Relevant Radio, proud sponsors of the 2012 Focus Student Leadership Summit, Illuminate. Launching by Curtis Martin.
Great to be with you. Great to be with you. You have dug deeply this weekend. I'm so proud of you. I'm walking the halls. I'm meeting students. They have no idea where they are. They haven't slept in days. It is great. It is great. And the finish line is just around the corner. And it'll be great. We'll be marching with our brothers and sisters tomorrow to defend life. And right now is a time to kind of look in the rearview mirror and say, where have we been, so that we can then discover where is God calling us to go. And I'm excited to be with you during this time this evening, to be able to kind of recap just a little bit and then hopefully look forward, because this is not a conference. This is a launching pad. This is an effort for us to get together and realize, in a culture that lacks the role models of the saints in front of us and before our eyes, we have to look back into history and see the great saints in history, and then we also have to be trained so that you can become the role models. So that, as St. Paul said so many years ago, follow me as I follow Christ. That's your invitation, to be that kind of leader, to be able to live in such a way. And so we've had some skills that have been trained to us this week, and we've also been able to be hopefully inspired and encouraged. And by the way, that story about the wedding's not true. But we have had some great experiences, but none of them will really make all that much difference if it doesn't really come to bear fruit in our lives. And so I'd like to start with a passage from the Gospel of John, chapter 15, verse 8, as kind of a launching pad, because I think we, as we hear our Lord in John, chapter 15, verse 8, we get a sense of his heart in a very profound way. And it touches right on where we are. I believe that he wants to speak to you and to me tonight about this very issue. Jesus says this: by this my Father is glorified, that you bear much fruit, and so prove to be my disciple. Jesus was a son who, through his faithfulness, bore much fruit and brought glory to his Father. And by this his Father's glorified, that we bear much fruit and prove to be the disciples of Christ. And we've looked at if you want to be a disciple, you have to take the discipline, and we have to choose to follow on the path. He's given us his example and his teachings, and it's an invitation for us to sit back and say, I have an opportunity to live differently, to be a man or a woman, just as the book of Hebrews says, of whom the world is not worthy. That's your invitation. To kind of at the end of life, sit back and say, oh, game over, what's next? This is what God has called us to recognize we're playing for all the marbles. To recognize that in a very real way, this is the one thing that matters. And anything else that might matter only matters if we get this right. If we were to gain all the wealth and all the power and all the prestige and all the success the world has to offer and miss on this, then we miss. And if we never really got everything the world had to offer, but we nailed this, we win. This is what life is all about. And so I'd like to take a look at the first couple sentences in the catechism, because I think the first couple sentences in the catechism lead us into the heart of the gospel. That's the purpose of the catechism, is to teach us what the faith is. And when I took speech communication courses in college, and one of the things that I was taught was that when you want to give a speech or when you're going to write something, you know what's important by how you begin or how you end or what you repeat. And so I think the beginning of the catechism is very, very important. And the catechism begins with a beautiful, beautiful statement. It says, God, infinitely perfect and blessed in himself, in a plan of sheer goodness, freely created man to make him share in his own blessed life. That is such good news. And I want to spend just a moment here with you to talk about that good news. God, the gospel of God, this is, I like to call it the gospel before sin, that God is infinitely perfect and blessed in himself. We live in a world that does not believe this about God. They are afraid of him. They don't like him. They think he's mean or that he's judgmental. It's not that they don't believe he exists. They do believe he exists. They don't like him. If you don't believe me, go talk to him. I love going to schools because I like going during the different fall seasons when the outreach. You know my favorite group to go talk at, in the fall outreach? I love the atheist groups. I love to go talk to them. They're my favorite because they're just very fun because, you know, you got to work hard to be an atheist. You actually have to have a club. And I always like to point out to them, you know, there is no I don't believe in unicorn club. Why? Because there's no such thing as unicorns. So you don't need to have a club. But you actually have to think about it and plan and organize to pretend you don't believe in God. And if you talk to them a little bit about being an atheist, you know what will happen? If you talk to them, why do you believe that? They start to get angry. You can't get angry with God if he doesn't exist. See, what they've done is they've never heard the gospel before sin, and they only look at the world after sin, and they blame him for it. And our job is to be able to present the gospel before sin, and then explain sin, and then explain the gospel after sin. So I want to take a look. This is the gospel before sin, is that God is infinitely imperfect and blessed in himself, and in a plan of sheer goodness created you and me to share in his blessed life. The second sentence in the catechism is similar to this, and it builds upon it. And it's so important for us to understand that. We have to see that as we look at the catechism and see what it has to say, it continues on and builds with this. It says, for this reason, what reason? For the reason that God is infinitely perfect and blessed in himself, and in a plan of sheer goodness, freely created you and me to share in his blessed life. For this reason, at every time and in every place, God draws close to man. He calls man to seek him and to know him, to love him with all of his strength. You know, I have to admit, I stand before you tonight, and I want to make a confession that I've actually lied to you. Not all of you, because I haven't said this before, but I have lied to some of you. I didn't mean to. It was not a total lie. It was a half-truth. Because I've taught for years, before I read this sentence and realized I was wrong, I taught for years that the work of the evangelist was to go out on college campus and find the men and women who are going through a season of grace. There are moments in your life when we're more open to God, and there are moments that we're less open to God. And our job was just to go out on campus and hope that God would lead us, and we'd pray for people. And our goal was to try to find people in a moment of grace so that we could share the good news with them, and they would be able to respond to it. And that's actually not true, because the catechism teaches something different. The catechism teaches that at all times, in every place, God draws close to man. Because in a plan of sheer goodness, he created us. And so what I've realized is that the moments, the seasons of grace are true. We're more responsive sometimes than others. There are times when we're going to hear something and we'll respond. And that's an amazing moment. You probably wouldn't be here if you haven't had those moments of grace. And every man and woman will experience those moments of grace. But here's the part I didn't tell you before. It doesn't matter whether they're in a moment of grace or not, because whether or not they are, when you present the truth of Christ in love, it'll stick to their hearts even if they're not ready to hear it. Even if they're not ready to hear it. I want to give you a couple examples of this. I was in a philosophy class. It was a bad place in my life. I think the philosophy class was about 10:30 in the morning. It was a freshman college class. I think that I probably attended the 10:30 a.m. philosophy class after a few beers more times than I did sober. I wasn't trying very hard. The philosopher was kind of a wild guy, and he would just say crazy stuff. And he was kind of fun and entertaining. And I was sitting there one day, and he was going through Plato's Allegory of the Cave. I don't know if you've heard it. I won't go there tonight. But he was sharing it, and then he said, you know, this issue, and this is what he said to me. I mean, I probably had three or four beers in me. I don't know. I was not in a moment of grace. I wasn't in a season of grace. I wasn't ready to like, oh, I'd like to live differently today. No, that was not it at all. I was just looking for entertainment. And he said this. He said, after the Plato's Allegory of the Cave, he said, you know, if you were to spend your life pursuing the truth, you would enter into an amazing adventure which would change your life for the better. And I remember sitting back in, you know, the 20th row going, that's pretty cool. Truth. That happened almost 30 years ago. I remember it still. In fact, I remember years later, I was having breakfast with some friends, and the philosopher walked into the restaurant. And I go to talk to this guy. And I mean, literally my life didn't change. Didn't change for weeks, didn't change for months, didn't change for years. But I remembered the little thought grenade that was sitting in my brain waiting to go off later. And it did later. And I remember walking up to him years later after I'd given my life to Christ and had come back to the Catholic Church. I walked up and I said, I don't know if you remember me. I'm sure you don't. You've taught a lot of people. I just want to let you know. I was sitting in your class one day, probably 7 years ago, and you shared with me that if I were to dedicate my life to the pursuit of the truth, it would lead me into a great adventure and change my life for the better. And I want to tell you, if it weren't for you, I don't know that I would have taken that challenge. But because of you, I began to pursue the truth, and several years later discovered that Jesus Christ is the truth and that he founded the Catholic Church. And I'm a member of the Catholic Church because of you. And he went, okay. Because he wasn't really in a season of grace at that moment. I can remember a few years later, and I was not in a season of grace. I already had the philosophy thing that hadn't had an impact on my life. And I'm now, a couple years later, and I'm with my mother. We're in New Orleans, Louisiana. And my grandfather, woo, go New Orleans. And go Tiger. Oh, no, that's a different story. Yeah, I know, it hurts me too. So I just realized when Alabama defeated LSU that this was a broken world, because that would never happen in heaven. But anyway, yes. All right. Back to the story. So I'm in Louisiana. My mom is from Louisiana. My grandfather was sick. He was literally in a hospital bed dying. And my mom had to go back to visit him because he was preparing for death. And she didn't want to go alone. And my dad said, would you accompany your mother? Now, my mom and I were not getting along, because I was living a pretty messed up life and didn't want her to know about it, because that would just make her yell more. And so I was lying to her regularly, and we just weren't getting along. And all of a sudden, I found myself in New Orleans with my mother and my dying grandfather. And we walked into the room, and my grandfather was in a lot of pain. I didn't recognize him. He had lost so much weight, skin and bones. And he was grumpy because he was in pain. And he was, his language was, you know, colorful. And I was taken aback because I had never seen somebody suffer like this before. And my mother, just a great Catholic daughter, she said, I'll be back in a minute. I need to go call a Catholic priest. And so she went and called a Catholic priest. And an hour or so later, there's a knock at the door. And a priest comes in his clerics. And he says, hello, did you call? And my grandfather looks at this priest and says, what the hell is he doing here? I don't want to talk to a priest. Now, I wasn't in a good place with God. I'm pretty sure that's not a good thing to do. And so I thought, oh my goodness. I mean, if I was going to get ready to die, I don't think I want to be yelling at priests. And I'm no theologian, you know, but but the priest was great. The priest was great. He just looked at me and my mom, and he said, why don't you two go get a cup of coffee and give us 20 minutes or half an hour? So we walked down the hall, and I'm thinking, man, yelling at priests, that's kind of bad. And so we have our cup of coffee, and I don't remember what we talked about, and walked back in the room, and my grandfather was a different man. I never heard him curse the rest of his life. He had been changed in a half an hour. I didn't know exactly what happened until he told me a little later. And I watched my grandfather live the last couple days of his life and then die in the peace of Christ and head off towards heaven with the sacraments of the church. And I'm not sure, I'm not his judge. I don't know where he would have gone, but I'm not sure he was heading the same direction when we first got there. And I just remembered thinking, again, not a real season of grace, wasn't ready to change my life. I just thought, you know, there probably are at least two paths in life, and it would really be a good idea to get on the right path sooner or later. I didn't go home and change my life. My mom and I didn't start getting along any better. If you had tried to evangelize me right then, you would have felt like a failure. But those two moments and many others forever changed my life. And my encouragement to you is to recognize that you will never fail in the work of evangelization. You may feel like a failure, but you will never fail, because the word of God will never return void. God is at all times and in every place reaching out to the people you're speaking with. He never leaves them alone. Your loving presentation of the love and mercy and goodness of Jesus Christ is like Velcro to their heart. They just can't not let it stick to them. They have to. And so I want you to have courage, because you cannot fail in this, but you will often feel like you're failing. But there's a tremendous difference. And so we need to persevere, because the second part of the gospel is sin. The reason people hate God is not because God is bad. God is amazing. The reason that people hate God is because they look at the world, which is radically broken, and blame him, because they don't know the teaching about sin. That there's original sin that has set the cosmos and all the people we know and everything we see off and out of balance with a profound wound. And that wound touches into our very hearts, so that we not only are affected by sin, but we find ourselves born on the wrong side of the battle. We actually find ourselves conspiring with the enemy because of our personal sin. And the gospel after sin is that Jesus Christ, because he is a God who is infinitely good and perfect in himself, and in a plan of sheer goodness created you and me to share in his life, didn't give up on us when sin wounded us, but began to pursue us and will never stop pursuing us because he loves us. And we, with our joy, need to radiate this message to the world, because when we testify to the goodness of God, not only that he would create us in a plan of sheer goodness, but that desire for our blessedness is so deep that when we were lost, he would come and seek us, even at great personal expense, dying on the cross for us. And the catechism goes on to teach us that Jesus, when he lived and when he died, thought individually and specifically about each of us. So that it's not just true to say he died for us. It's even more profoundly true to say he died for you. He died for me. It was very, very personal for him. And he wants it to be very, very personal for you. You know, so this is the issue about Christianity. It reminds me of a time that I was out at Lake Michigan. And I was out in Lake Michigan. We had some young kids at the time. And there was a rowboat. And I was going to take one of our younger kids out on the rowboat. And I think we had three kids at the time. I was taking the youngest one. And he had a little, like, you know, life vest on and stuff like that. Didn't know how to swim. He wanted to go on the boat. And I thought it would be great father-son bonding time. It'll be a lot of fun. We'll go out. I won't go out too far, 100 yards or whatever. And I'll row around. It'll be really fun. And my wife did not want me to do this, because women actually don't trust their husbands with their kids. They don't. And in a certain sense, it's kind of fair, because we do play by different rules. You know, but when my wife watches the kids, she wants them to do their homework and clean the house. I just don't want them to bleed on the carpet. You know, and so it's a different set of rules. And so I'm taking the boat out, and my wife is giving this look like, you're going to kill one of our kids. And so I get out about 100 yards, and I'm now kind of goofing around, and my son has kind of gotten up to the bow, and he's playing around, and he's got his hand over the side, and he's ripping his fingers in, and I'm like, woohoo! And my wife's looking at me like, whatever, I got this. And my son falls in to Lake Michigan. Now, it's early, like in the late spring, early summer, so he's got a life vest on, but the water is like 31 degrees. And so he's going, and he's starting to cough because he's getting water in his mouth. And my wife is over there going, I knew it. But I am, you know, a typical guy. So I'm like, I got this. I got it. And so I casually wait until my son is right by me, and I'm going to reach right over, and I'm just going to grab him and pull him back in the boat and go, ha, told you I could take care of this. And as I looked, and I just like a receiver, I took my eye off the ball. Just as he was right there, I looked up at my wife, and I missed him. So here's the deal. The water is 31 degrees. I mean, 1 degree colder, you could walk on it. And And I love my son, but he did not want to get in the lake. But I actually had no choice. Because now I was beginning to think my wife might be right. Because my son, I mean, he's got a life vest on, but he's coughing and he's in great distress because he's very uncomfortable. He's got water in his mouth. And so I, of course, jump out of the boat, which is a really miserable experience. And my wife is watching this, and I am trying to still act like I got my act together, but now I'm going, and it was really brutal. It was not fun at all. But I had to get my son back in the boat. And Jesus Christ did that for you, because I promise you, heaven was way better than the boat, and earth is way less than the water. I mean, he had never experienced pain or cold or any deprivation at all. And he came and he was born in poverty. He jumped out of the boat for you and for me. Because it wasn't about him being safe. It was about him rescuing us. And he's asking you to be a disciple and jump out of the boat. To do things that just aren't comfortable. To do things you actually just don't want to do. Oh, I know it's probably a good idea. I just actually don't want to do it. And to do it anyway. Even when we don't feel like it. Because he loved us first. And he jumped out of the boat for us first. And to be able to see that God is calling us to live a radically different life. To be able to see that he's got such great and amazing plans for us. And that involves you thriving and living a life with some of the people that you're going to reach out to. Some of the best friends, the most amazing friends I have in my life are people who have had a God-shaped impact in my life or who I have been able to have a God-shaped impact in theirs. That bond is a greater bond than anything I know. And to be able to live that kind of life, I want to share a story with you that it comes from the scriptures. And I want to spend just a couple of verses. It comes from John chapter 1. It's just a couple of verses I want to read to you. It was shared with me earlier this weekend. We're recapping. This was one of the things that kind of struck me from the weekend. It's the beginning of our Lord's public ministry. And it says that Jesus was walking along, and he comes across John the Baptist, and John the Baptist greets him this way. "Behold the Lamb of God." And the two disciples heard him speak, and they followed Jesus. Now, we know that it's from the other Gospels, we know that this is the Apostle John and the Apostle Andrew. But it's not clear from John's Gospel, but we learn from the other one. So this is John and Andrew, and they hear their mentor look at Jesus and say, "Behold the Lamb of God." And they immediately leave their mentor, John the Baptist, the man who Jesus said was the greatest man born of woman. They leave him and begin to follow Jesus. And Jesus turned and beheld them following and said to them, "What do you seek?" And they said to him, "Rabbi," which means teacher, "where are you staying?" And he said to them, "Come and you will see." They came therefore and saw where he was staying, and they stayed with him that day, for it was about 4:00. I want to look at this. It's an interesting statement. It didn't hit me until I was asked the question earlier this weekend. Why, the Gospels, every part of the Bible, but the Gospels, I mean, they're pretty short. This is the most important person who ever lived on earth. They're pretty short. Every word counts. Why would you say, it was about 4:00? Think about it for a second, though. This is the Gospel of John. The Gospel of John is written probably, there's some debate, but I'm going to guess it's written probably in the late 60 AD. So probably 30, 35, maybe close to 40 years after the life of Jesus. And it's written by John. And John, as he writes this, is remembering the day that he met Jesus Christ. It's about 4:00. 40 years later, he knew what time of day it was when his life changed. What's your 4:00? If you've got one, thank God for it. If you don't, let this be your 4 o'clock. To be that moment when you decide, I'm all in. I have thought about you. I like you. I hope that you bless me. But none of that really matters because from now on, I just love you. I'm all yours. I give you everything that I have. And if we can live that, if we can find our 4 o'clock and know this is when we've chosen to follow the Lord, then God will do amazing things in our lives. We'll be able to have the courage to jump out of the boat and to live radically for Jesus Christ, to realize we need to be trained because in a great world when everything's healthy and holy, it's wonderful. We have role models who teach us. We live in a world with very few role models. We've replaced heroes with celebrities, which means we have to raise up a new generation of heroes who can be role models for us, living saints, which means we have to be trained in things that we should have been able to learn by watching. But you've been trained this weekend, and I beg you to go back to campus and deepen that love. Because if, as I said to you Friday evening, if you become who you're meant to be, you will set the world on fire. I am honored to try to serve alongside you. You are an anointed generation, a group of people called by destiny to change the world. Become who you're meant to be and set the world on fire. Thank you.
This talk was given at the 2012 Focus Student Leadership Summit, Illuminate. For additional talks or other great resources for the new evangelization, please visit www.shopfocus.org.